Would you join me in the book of Joshua this morning, chapter 2? Joshua chapter 2 today, and we continue our odyssey through this book. Again, let me remind you that we are working through this book in pericopes, sections of Scripture that are logical units together, and all of chapter 2 then becomes one pericope in that sense, because it's a single story with great detail, but it is still just a single story. And because this morning we're going to be celebrating the Lord's Supper as we close our time in worship, we will break this story then into two sermons. We'll start this morning looking at the contextual portion of the chapter, and then, Lord willing, next week we'll come back and see the covenantal part of the story. So this morning I want to just look at the first seven verses, and I'm not going to read the entirety of the chapter up front. Let me encourage you in our working through Joshua to do that before you come to church on Sunday morning. Just take the time to read ahead to whatever it is I'm going to be covering. Obviously, since we're going to be looking at chapter 2 again next week, you should reread chapter 2 again at home. Shouldn't take you but a few minutes to do so, but it helps in that you are familiar with what we're talking about as we go along. Now, let's talk about where this chapter is in the story, and you will notice that chapter 2 of Joshua is an insertion. It is inserted into the flow of the book as a whole. In chapter 1, Joshua commands the people to be prepared. Well, first he gets his instructions from God, right? He gets his commission, and then he instructs the people to get ready, get prepared to go out and cross the Jordan. But the crossing of the Jordan doesn't occur until chapter 3. And so this piece of text is inserted into the narrative at this point here. Thus, there is some question as to exactly when these events actually occur. The word sent in verse 1 is a bit ambiguous, and even the ESV notes it in a footnote. And Joshua the son of Nun sent two men secretly from Shittim as spies. That word sent is a bit ambiguous. We don't know exactly what it means. It could mean either is sending or sent in the past. And it's more likely the idea of having already sent, implying an earlier time. In other words, the events of these spies going to Jericho could have occurred prior to the command of chapter 1. In other words, it could be that the way it would go is that Joshua and the people arrive in Gilead. He sends spies across the Jordan to scope out Jericho. They come back and they say to him, yes, we can go in. It's at that point that he rises up and says, okay, people, let's get prepared. Let's go. And he gets his commissioning from the Lord, and then they head out. Okay, so this could be something that Joshua did even before he gave the command to cross into Canaan. You could make a very good argument that the success of the report of the spies at the end of chapter 2 is what compels Joshua to actually get up and go and say to the people, let's go. So that's the position that I think is most reasonable. And I think he includes this chapter then for clarity as he's writing the narrative along later on in time. He realizes, I need to put that in there. I need to remind the people of Israel that I had already sent spies into the land in preparation, and they went out in utter obedience to the fact that these spies had come back and said, yep, we can go. Okay? All right, so the spies are sent by Joshua into the land, and as I just read, the Israelites are camped at a place called Shittim. Shittim is in the plains of Moab, just east of the Jordan. Last week I referred to it as Gilead. That's another way of speaking of the territory, just to the east of the Jordan River, on the other side of the Jordan from where the Israelites are eventually going to go. This is the area, you remember, I pointed out that the tribes of Reuben and Gad and Manasseh had said that they wanted to settle. Specifically, the tribes of Reuben and Gad had come to Moses, you remember, and said, we want to settle here. And Moses had included a half-tribe of Israel for some reason in that. This is where they are at. Their entry into this area, their coming into this place as a people, is recorded in Numbers 22-25, specifically outlined as to where they went. And you remember that also includes in those chapters the events of their encounter with Balaam. We talked about Balaam back in Jude, remember? Some of you do. that was the time frame here. This is also just after the Israelites have defeated the kings of Sihon and Og in the territory of the Amorites. As they are coming north through Edom and then through Moab, they encounter two kings, Sihon and Og, in the territory of the Amorites, and they defeat them. Now, I point that out because this is critical. Them having defeated the kings of Sihon and Og are the very reason why such fear falls on the people of Jericho when the spies come. It is what gives impetus to a great deal of this story. The fact that the news of the defeat of these two kings has come to the people of Canaan, and it becomes the impetus behind Rahab's willingness to hide these spies in exchange for her life. Notice verse 10. "We have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea before you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon and Og, whom you devoted to destruction." See it? She remembers, she knows of this event, both of them, the Exodus which occurred 40 years earlier, and then just recently the defeat of these two kings. It becomes an impetus in the story behind her willingness to hide the spies. Their journey from Sinai, which took 40 years, you remember, is summarized in Numbers 33. And the last place that they settle in that Numbers 33 account is a place called Abel Shittim, shortened to just Shittim in verse 1 of chapter 2. It's the last place they are. They arrive here at the time of the harvest, which means that they arrive in April. They arrive in the spring. They arrive during the days of the Passover festival. And Joshua then sends spies across the Jordan in advance of the people crossing into Canaan. They arrive, and Joshua sends the spies in advance. So they're going to Jericho before the people come across. Now, this leads us to a natural question. Why does Joshua send spies across the Jordan into Canaan if God has already told him what the outcome is going to be? I mean, if God has already said to him, no man's going to stand before you, the people I'm going to give over to utter destruction, you will be successful, why does Joshua send spies into the city of Jericho to check it out? See, that's one of those kind of questions you should be asking yourself when you're reading the Bible. You shouldn't just be reading it along and just assuming the text just says what it says. It's good to ask critical questions. And if you haven't figured it out yet, that's what you pay me to do. So I'm asking a critical question. Why? All right. Let's surmise some possible reasons. Number one, it's possible that Joshua sends spies into Canaan because he's a good military leader, okay? And he understands that the best thing to do is to scope out the enemy, find out what it is, what's going on in the city of Jericho. Let me go and find out what their defenses are, what their military capability are, what their morale is like. All those kinds of things would be the sort of things you'd want to know before you attack a city. So maybe Joshua's just being a good military leader. In fact, I think that's the reason most often given to why Joshua sent these spies, because he was simply doing what is reasonable to do as a military leader. But there's another possible reason, and that is that maybe Joshua wants to show the people again that they can and will take this land. After all, Joshua sending spies into Canaan smells familiar, doesn't it? Wasn't he a member of a team of men who went into Canaan himself 40 years earlier and came out and told Moses and the people, yes, we could take this land? Remember his friend Caleb who said, we can do this? And remember the people said, no, we can't do it, because the other spies said, we can't go, they're like giant men, they're covered like grasshoppers, and we can't do this. And the people listened to them, and God punished them and sent them into the wilderness for 40 years. Doesn't this seem like deja vu all over again? Yeah, it does. So maybe this is Joshua doing exactly what had happened 40 years earlier by sending another set of spies that bring back a similar report. They come out with a similar report. No big deal. We take this city. It's ours. We could take it. No big deal. If God is on our side, okay? So maybe another reason that Joshua does this by sending spies is that when they come back, they'll be able to give a good report. And he'll be able to say to the people, okay now, let's not do what we did 40 years ago. Let's do the right thing this time. Okay? But you know me, there's another reason here. And this is the best one of the list. Why does Joshua send spies into Canaan? Because maybe, unknown to Joshua, the spies are sovereignly purposed by God for a greater good. Maybe the whole idea of sending spies, certainly perfectly legitimate that we'll go scope it out, or perfectly legitimate we want the people to, once again, you know, do what they're supposed to do. But maybe it's the living God himself who nudges Joshua, hey, send a couple of spies in because I have something far greater that I want to do through those spies. God has a remnant in Jericho. God has a people he knows in Jericho that he has elect to himself, and he uses the spies to discover them. Who are they? There's a people in Jericho that have been set aside by the living God to be his own people, saved by grace. They're going to be saved even though the city is going to be destroyed. In other words, the spies finding Rahab and her family is actually the purpose of God to be part of his larger plan. And God will make Rahab a part of the line of the eventual seed of Israel that will come through her. Remember, Rahab is one of the five women included in the genealogical record of the Christ in Matthew chapter 1. She's one of the women. In fact, she's one actually named. And she is, if you remember, according to the genealogy, the grandmother of Boaz, who becomes the great-grandfather of David. She is included also in the great Faith Hall of Fame in Hebrews chapter 11, specifically for her faith in this incident. The writer will specifically point to this incident and put her in that great Hall of Fame of people from the Old Testament who trusted in God by faith and they were saved. And she is referenced as an example of living faith in James chapter 2. She is justified, the writer says, because of her efforts. She is held up as a picture of someone who not only trusted in God, but actually did something that demonstrated her faith. That she wasn't just a professing believer. She was a person who trusted in God and acted upon her trust in God. See it? The sovereign hand of God is to have Joshua send two spies into the city of Jericho, and they just happen to go to the house of a prostitute who just happens to be eventually a part of the very genealogy of Christ. There's no happens about this at all. This is the sovereign hand of God sending two spies into this place to find this woman and her family. The spies go to the house of Rahab, a prostitute who lived in the city. She lives, according to verse 15, in the city wall. Now, we discover as the spies come that it is not difficult for them to come into the city. According to verse 5, the gates are open. And the reason why the gates would be open during the day in the city is because people would be going in and out of the city a lot. You would leave the city in order to go out to farm. You would leave the city to go out to collect water. You would leave the city to go out and trade with those passing by. There would be a great deal of reason to leave the city during the day, and there would be a great deal of people going in and out of the city. And so it would not be too difficult for strangers to come into the city. They were probably coming all the time. So it wouldn't be an unusual thing. The city of Jericho is a Middle Bronze Age city-state. Middle Bronze Age is roughly 2200 to about 1550 BC. Basically, the time of the patriarchs is considered the Middle Bronze Age. This is part of Middle Bronze Age 2. In those days, nations were not nations. There were no national boundaries as we think of them. Rather, what you had are small cities that came up who acted as city-states. The city had a king and its local government. The people lived in and around the city itself. These cities had several characteristics in common in that particular day. They were typically built upon a hill so that the city could look out and see off in the distance of any coming enemies that would be coming in their direction. They were walled for protection. They were always close to a water source, typically a well or spring nearby. The city of Jerusalem, for example, when David took it, had a water spring close by, and David expanded the size of the city and the wall to include the spring inside of the city eventually. The cities were also typically surrounded by arable land, meaning that they could be farmed. You didn't need to go too far away then in order to farm, and obviously in an agrarian society as this was, you would need farmable land to be able to survive. And most of these cities are situated on major roads, major highways going east or west or north and south. The city of Jericho sits, what we think is Jericho, sits on what would be a significant international highway running north and south through the area. The city of Jericho was probably about 10 acres in size. Not very big. Really rather small, if you think about it, from our perspective. And there were maybe 1,000 to 1,500 inhabitants in the city as a whole. Jericho had a double wall. It had two walls, an outer wall which had typically a moat built around it. This one may have had a moat, we're not sure, around the outside of it. And what they would typically do is build that outer wall down to the moat and then plaster the outside of the wall to make it so it couldn't be scaled, make it slippery on the outside. And they would specifically pour oil and water and other things down that plaster when an enemy would come to keep them from scaling the wall. But there would also be an inner wall inside of that. So there'd be an outer wall and an inner wall. In the event that the outer wall somehow was breached, the inner wall then would continue to serve as protection. The two walls then are a waste of space if you just build two walls. And so they typically would space the two walls enough apart that you could actually inhabit the space between them. And so there was enough space between the two walls for Rahab and her family to have a home. The city of Jericho is situated at what is called the back door to the hill country. It's about 5 miles to the west of the Jordan, at the edge of its lush valley moving towards the west, northwest of the Dead Sea, maybe 7 to 10 miles. In other words, at the lower end of the Jordan Valley, just to the edge of its lush territory. It was situated in a perfect place, if you will, for all the things I mentioned up above. The exact location of the city of Jericho is unknown, even to today. We have no idea where it was. Bryant Wood in the early 20th century suggested that it was part of what was called City 4, which was being excavated at the time, although there was another archaeologist who denied that particular presence. The fact is that us not being able to find Jericho makes perfect sense, because two things are true about Jericho. Number one, the city was destroyed. And number two, it was cursed, never to be rebuilt. You remember specifically in Joshua chapter 6, after Joshua is destroyed, a curse is placed upon anyone who will attempt to rebuild the city. And that curse comes true when a man by name of Hiel, in 1 Kings 16:34, attempts to rebuild it at the cost of his firstborn and secondborn sons. Us not being able to find Jericho makes sense. God wiped it from the face of the earth. So Jericho is a Middle Bronze Age city that these spies enter. So why go to her house? No reason is given in this text. Is it to go to her house? Let me speculate that it's logical, I would think, for visitors, dare I say even strangers, to go to the house of a prostitute, because visitors and strangers in such a house would not be unusual nor raise suspicion. I mean, that's what such women do, and so it would not cause or raise suspicion amongst others that there would be strangers in her house. Given their interaction, it is highly unlikely that the men used her services. More than likely, given that Rahab knows about the history of the Israelites, and as we see as this text unfolds, desires to come under their protection, it seems that she invites them in purposely. She seeks them out, is what it appears. The way this text flows, that seems most reasonable to me, and she does so as her hope. In other words, the spies go to her house because they are directed there, both by God and by her. Now, in verse 2, something happens, however. And behold, it was told to the king of Jericho, men of Israel have come here tonight to search out the land. Then the king of Jericho said to Rahab, saying, bring out the men who have come to you, who entered your house, for they have come to search out all the land. All right, so what are you supposed to do with that? You're supposed to ask a question. And what's the question you're supposed to ask? How in the world did he find out that these spies were in her house? Again, as I just said, it would not be unreasonable for there to be strangers in her house. How did he find out? And how did he find out so specifically that they were sent from Israel and had come to spy out the city? You will notice that in verse 1 it tells us that Joshua sends these two men out secretly. And there's no one else who knows their intent. I'm going to go so far as to express an opinion here. And that opinion is this. I don't think anybody else in Israel even knows that Joshua has sent these spies. I think that word secretly at the beginning of verse 1 means that Joshua himself decided to send two men. He sent them and he didn't tell anybody else he was doing so. That's what secretly in that verse implies to me. Nobody knows what these two men are doing except Joshua and them. And that's it. How did the king find this out? Well, maybe someone overhears them discussing their plans with Rahab and reports it. Family member, maybe? Family member of Rahab living nearby or in the same area or even in the same house that may have her overheard this and became worried about it. And reports it. I mean, after all, the flow of the narrative seems to imply such a discussion before verse 2, doesn't it? I mean, look at verse 2. And it was told to the king of Jericho. Immediately before that says, they went and came to the house of a prostitute whose name was Rahab and lodged there. The implication being that between the two verses, somehow the knowledge of who they are gets out. And the most reasonable explanation is that the spies come to Rahab. Rahab knows who they are, or they tell her who they are, and that information gets out. There's a discussion that probably takes place there just before verse 2. And as I pointed out earlier, the city is not that big. And it would be easy then for rumors to spread about some strangers who are in the house of Rahab. And we've heard some rumor about them talking to Rahab about something, about being part of those Israelites that are camped over on the other side of the Jordan. And maybe, if you look at verse 10, the presence of the Israelites is well known in the city. Notice, as I read you before, we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea before you, etc. The king of Jericho knows there's a couple million Israelites camped on the other side of the Jordan, about 5 miles away. It's not unsurprising that he would know that. It's not as though the Israelites have snuck up at night. You know, as though 2 million people in their flocks and herds can sneak up and show up in a place and not everybody freak out, especially given the fact that they've just defeated two of the kings on the other side, and the knowledge of that would certainly have gotten into Canaan that these Israelites took out a couple of significant kings. They know this. And so there is probably a deep, well, not probably, there is a deep paranoia in this city at this time. In fact, Rahab herself will express that paranoia even in her own encounter with the spies. And so, it's possible that somebody simply overhears them discussing their plans and reports it to the king. But, you know me, again, I have another theory. It's a better theory. It's always a better theory, by the way. Maybe God Himself makes the presence of the spies known. Maybe God Himself tips the hand of these spies while they're in that place in order to do something. What would this precipitate? Well, the response of the king is what precipitates Rahab's choice. Right? The king comes to her and says, send out the guys that you have hiding in your house. And Rahab has a choice. Maybe God specifically does this in order to force her faith out. Notice verse 12. Now then, okay, this is Rahab speaking to the spies. Now then, please swear to me by the Lord that as I have dealt kindly with you, you also deal kindly with my father's house and give me a sure sign. And that is followed by this great confession in verses 9 to 11 of who God is. Is it possible that God caused the spies to be found out so that Rahab would be forced to protect them, and that doing so would solidify her confession of faith, her choice to trust the God of the Israelites? What if God Himself said, I have put faith into the heart of Rahab. I have set her aside to myself. I have elect her. And so I'm going to force her faith out, and here's how I'm going to do it. I'm going to let the knowledge of the spies be made known to the king. The king is going to come to her, and she's going to have to stand up and do what is right. Because that is what I, Jehovah, have desired. And the way this story flows out, I don't think you can miss that point, do you? Her choice to trust the God of the Israelites comes as a reaction to the king. I mean, if the king had never come to her and the spies had just come and then was spading out of the house and then just left without having any confrontation with the authorities, there would be nothing for Rahab to actually do to express that she was trusting in the God of Jehovah. In other words, what she says in verse 12 is, as I have dealt kindly with you, now you must deal kindly with me. I'm trusting you, or more specifically, I'm trusting your God in what I have done. See it? Which leads, by the way, to the most controversial part of this particular story. But before we get there, let's go down to verses 6 and 7. Let's skip over 4 and 5 for a moment and just jump down to 6 and 7. She had brought them, that is the spies, up to the roof and hid them with stalks of flax that she had laid in order on the roof. So the men pursued after the spies on the way to the Jordan as far as the fords. Okay. Her habitation in the city, as I mentioned earlier, was in the wall. It was between the inner and outer wall. It was built specifically for habitation. In other words, don't waste the space. The roof, then, would have been a wooden structure suspended between the two walls, a wooden lattice system between the two walls, potentially even embedded in the two walls, and then covered with flax, in this case, thatch. So what she had was a thatched roof over the top of her place there in between the two walls. The stalks of flax were probably gleaned from the field after the harvest and used as a thatch. Cut the tops off with the grain on it and then leave the rest of the thatch to go glean that and use it as thatching material on the top of the roof. So Rahab hid the spies in that thatch on the roof. If the men came to her house to search the house, do you think they did? Do you think they did? Yeah, I think they did. They came to the house, searched the house, and they didn't realize that they're walking around right underneath them because they're up above in the roof. So I wanted you to see that first, because now let's go back to verses 4 and 5. The king comes to her and says, bring the men out. And she says, verse 4, but the woman had taken the two men and hidden them. So verses 6 and 7 explains that. And she said, true, the men came to me, but I did not know where they were from. And when the gate was about to be closed at dark, the men went out. I do not know where the men went. Pursue them quickly, for you will overtake them. Now, you'll notice right at the outset, she confesses that the men did come to her house. Okay? She does confess that. But then she lies about three things. She lies about their origination. Where'd they come from? She said, I don't know where they were from. She knew that. She lies about their departure. They hadn't left. They're still in the roof. She says they've took out off the gate. Thirdly, she lies about where they went. They didn't go anywhere. They were still on the roof. So she lies. Now, the controversy, of course, that comes out of this passage is the fact that Rahab's protection of the spies is based on her lying. Right? And the controversy then is the assumption being that lying is always wrong, right? Right? We tell our kids, don't tell lies, that's always wrong. And so we come to this story and we have a woman who tells three big ones, and she is treated as a hero. And that becomes a controversy, right? I mean, after all, doesn't the ninth commandment prohibit lying? It doesn't, by the way. It prohibits making a false testimony against someone else in an official sense. But it's not about lying in a general sense. But let's just assume for the sake of argument that she is in fact lying, and we have to ask ourselves whether that's wrong. Let me ask you a couple of questions here. Think about this in terms of the story. Number one, who is Rahab lying to? Who's she lying to? Is she lying to someone who deserves to hear the truth? Or is she lying to someone who will use the truth that she tells her, if she were to tell the truth, in unrighteousness? We sort of look and assume that there's a moral equivalency here. Okay? And the moral equivalency is that regardless of who it is, you're always supposed to tell the truth. But what if the person you tell the truth to is unrighteous and uses your truth-telling to do what is unrighteous? I mean, what do you think the king would have done if Rahab had said, well, they're up there? What do you think he would have done? Pulled them down, killed them, don't you think? There's no doubt in my mind he would have killed them, because he would have wanted, the whole reason he was searching them out is because he knew they were in town to scope out the place, so you don't want the information getting back to Israel of what they had learned, so you kill them. So the first question you need to ask here is, who's she lying to? The answer to the question is she's lying to the already condemned king of the city. You understand what I just said, right? The man she's lying to has already been condemned to be destroyed by God. The Israelites were told, you're going to go to this city, you're going to destroy it, and you're going to devote to destruction everything and everybody in it. The king is already given over to the destruction, to destruction by God. So she's not looking into a face of a man who is righteous. No. She's looking into something else entirely, isn't she? But let me follow that up with a second question. Why is Rahab lying? I mean, that's kind of really the point, right? Why is she lying? Is she lying in order to further her own selfish interests? Or is she lying to protect an agent of God as a function in trusting in God Himself? I mean, we look at this and say, well, she's making a choice to either lie to protect those who God has sent or tell the truth and not trust in God. Because, by definition, if she would have told the truth, she would not have, in fact, been spared. There would be no covenant between these spies and her later. So the answer is this. To do what is good and right in the eyes of God is the issue. We look at lying and think it's a horrible thing. And we would teach our children well not to lie. I'm not suggesting to you that this is some sort of theological tome that allows you to lie in certain cases. But in the midst of a situation where there is no good alternative, meaning in a world that is sinful and fallen, and which the two choices that you have are to choose between telling a small fib or turning two men over to be murdered, which choice are you going to make? Now, I realize in many of your cases, kids, where you have an opportunity to speak to your parents, you're not given that choice, okay? And the parents are going, that's right, sir, that's correct. But in this particular case, what Rahab is forced to do is to choose between two realities in a sinful and fallen world. One of them is to tell a lie. The other is to cause the death of two men. I'm going to choose the lie. Now, let me point out something to you. You and I want to condemn Rahab kind of knee-jerk-like for her lie. But nowhere in Scripture is Rahab ever condemned for telling this lie. Never. There's no hint of it in this text. And none of the other passages that I mentioned to you earlier where Rahab is mentioned is never condemned. In fact, her lie elevates her in Scripture. The question here then for me is not, did Rahab lie? But rather, was her action in a fallen world consistent with a desire to trust in the living God over against keeping some sort of legalistic standard that we might impose? Because that's precisely what we're doing if we come to Rahab and condemn her for telling a lie. We're imposing a legalistic standard upon her that says, you should never tell a lie. No matter what the consequences might be, you should never tell a lie. That doesn't work in a fallen world, does it? Because the choices are never that black and white. And Rahab was placed into an untenable situation. Either you tell the truth and the men are killed, or you tell a lie and trust in God. I am convinced that this is not controversial at all. Not a bit. It's a small fib to an unrighteous man who doesn't deserve the truth, frankly, because he's already been condemned for what he will do if the truth is told. And it is part of her grander intent to trust in the God of the Israelites. In a sense, you might say that Rahab's lie is her making a choice between trusting in the king of Jericho versus trusting in the king of all the universe. Which one are you going to choose? So let us not be so quick to condemn her for telling a small lie. But let's consider, as we finish up this contextual part of the story, let's consider something. Think about this. God, Yahweh, the God of the Israelites, through these spies, sets aside to himself a prostitute, a liar, and a foreigner to himself. And I would add to that a pagan as well. I didn't write that in there. I thought of it later. A liar, a prostitute, a foreigner, and a pagan. And he sets her aside to be saved from destruction. Would it be fair to say that there's nothing inherently good in Rahab? Or us? But let's just stick with Rahab for the moment. You're getting personal. There's nothing good in Rahab. None of us would walk into the city of Jericho and go, yeah, the prostitute that lives in that hole in the wall is the one I'm going to set aside to myself. You and I wouldn't make that choice. But Yahweh did. And Yahweh sent these two spies to find that woman. There is nothing in her that is inherently good that would cause God to choose her. And as my friend here just said a moment ago, there's nothing inherently good for God to choose us either. It is a grand mistake for us to think that there is something good in us that would cause God to embrace us. Quite the contrary. Now, she would become then, of course, in this story, the perfect example of the undeserving nature of God's grace. You know, a woman that we would utterly dismiss as unworthy becomes the recipient of the unfettered mercy of God. That's who she is. She is an example to us of Yahweh saying, I have a remnant. I know who she is. She is mine. Even in the midst of this pagan people, a prostitute living in that place, I, Yahweh, have set my favor upon her. Rahab's faith flows out of the fact that the living God had set her aside to himself. And that is precisely what the living God has done for every one of us who call upon the name of the Lord to be saved. None of us deserve salvation. We are all prostitutes and liars and pagans and foreigners. All of us. There's nothing that we have done that has ever made God happy with us, pleased with us. There's nothing that's made us righteous in the sight of God. We live in a wall, practicing our paganisms and our rebellion against God. But He sets His mind upon us to save us. His choice to reveal Himself to her and to save her from the destruction she is destined for. Because she should have been destroyed in that city, just like all the rest of them would be. And God would have every right to do so without thinking twice. And the same is true with us. We all deserve to be cast into hell just like her.